Beaverton article. Mayor of Eggerville. Shit, shit, shit. Is the egg hatching? And they've done a they've done the egg with a velociraptor hatching out of it.
Nice.
Things that only Albertans and people that were married to Albertans understand.
The 9th day of December, 2018, and a 7.5-meter acoustic anvil sits in Leggenboot Square. This is the Camby Report. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Patrick Meehan.
And what a show do we have for you today. In the waning days of the year, we're going to talk about some of the goings-on at Vancouver Council. There's been just a flood of motions.
Rumor is there's many more in development. I've heard rumblings that there's at least one councillor that's sitting on at least 8 more motions.
Well, at least something's getting developed in Vancouver. Bazing!
Anyway.
But there is actually like a ton going on. The budget, of course, is going to be a big test of the new council, and so we'll get
possibly
to talk about that.
Or it may not be.
I mean, they're already trading barbs, but we'll get into it.
TransLink has like a couple of issues around the region, and democracy has consequences up in the district of North Vancouver.
And Surrey.
And Surrey, yes. And finally, the provincial climate change plan has been released. What impact will that have on municipalities? But first, Vancouver Council, rent evictions. Patrick, do you want to fill us in on what the Jean machine has brought?
Yeah, so Jean Swanson, obviously, you know, rent evictions are very core to her base, as well as her beliefs and importance is getting rid of this rent eviction issue, which had been plaguing Vancouver, is people with, you know, older rental units throwing out their tenants in order to do, you know, between minor to moderate renovations. Oftentimes, those renovations have been found to be very minor. You know, a coat of paint goes up and they rent it out again, 3 weeks later for $1,000 more per month than they had been getting before because the rental market had been going up so fast. So Jean's brought in a host of controls to try to prevent that from happening. Most importantly, what has now been approved by council is that a landlord that wants to renovate has to give the option to come back in at the same price to somebody that they're going to do a renovation for. So if you are choosing to put in a new wall and replace the toilet or whatever, you have to now give them the option to come back in.
Now, the way that you've structured it, or the way that you've put it in the show notes, is demand that landlords who displace tenants, what degree of control does the city actually have here?
Like I said, is the situation is that landlords will now have to offer the right of return.
Okay, so it's a mandatory policy, because like most of this stuff is not Vancouver's, and this is like the other part of Jean's motion, is not within the ambit of Vancouver's power.
No, but most of what was passed is within the power of Vancouver.
Yeah, there are two parts that seem to go through, and they went through unanimously. This part that we just talked about, this right of return, which seems reasonable. I mean, there are, I think, some caveats where if the landlord can justify that the property is worth that much more and costs this much to renovate, then they can apply to increase the rent a little bit for the person coming back. But it does mean you can't just be kicked out of your house.
I mean, it does mean you can be kicked out of your house, but they have to let you come back again.
Yeah, more.
Which, you know, it makes sense. If a water main breaks and you need to be out of the home for a period of time for the fix and the improvements, and then you can come back in. Similarly, if a landlord, under today's option, wanted to put in some new countertops and then rent it out for $1,000 more a month, they wouldn't be allowed to. And so this really does close a loophole that's been really harming a lot of people in the city and is likely to result in a lot of people having less precarious tenancies.
It was one of the things Jean campaigned on, and for her to be delivering it. I think the thing that really bears mentioning, though, we talk about the Jean machine, and this ended up getting a unanimous vote. And I think, I don't know if it was directly because of how this came through, but between her and the Vancouver Tenants Union, they had flooded council chambers with people lining up to speak and tell their stories, tell very personal stories of how they got kicked out of their apartment, how they can't afford to live in Vancouver. And it was just renter after renter telling personal and emotional stories that moved everyone to the point where it seemed politically unpalatable to say no to them, even for the NPA.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there was some, you know, amendments were made, some changes came in. Some things were referred back for reporting on what the cost implications would be or other implications. And in the end, like you said, is the NPA 100% agreed with it? There was some bandying about, though. You know, the Gene Machine did organize. The Vancouver Tenants Union came out. There was a lot of public pressure placed by them. And in a minor controversy, a number of councillors, and I haven't been able to get a final count on them, but I believe it was the NPA and Green councillors, together sat down the night before in what has been described as a closed room with the Landlords Association and talked about what their concerns were. Whereas, and Michael Weeb made this point publicly, he was really upset that all of the speakers were in favor of the motion and that nobody on the other side spoke.
Which immediately got compared, I heard. I don't know if it was Gene or if it was someone else. One of the supporters compared him to Trump for saying both sides, which was pretty bad.
It's balderdash. Yeah, and you know, when you do these changes, there could be significant unintended outcomes. I don't think in this situation the way that this is written is going to result in that. But you have to listen to the people that rent things out as well as the people that rent things like that. I'm trying to get that, and that's not working.
No. Yeah. You want to listen to both the
renters,
both supply and demand on the, yeah, you know, rental economic mm-hmm. world. But, like, you know, I think that this is actually going to do one particular thing, which is de-link the speculative nature of the Vancouver real estate market from the rental market. So, like, rental prices have been lagging behind real estate prices, like sale prices, by like 5 years or so. And it has, within the past 2 or 3 years, really started to destabilize as bad as the actual sale market has. That can be somewhat delinked if the economic incentive to put your rental property back on the market as a sale property doesn't exist anymore. And this does take away that some economic incentive. Yeah. It's a good right-wing policy. Well done, Gene Swanson.
Well, the other half of the motion that went through is, like you were saying, the city doesn't have a ton of authority in this area, so they are asking the provincial government to give them controls and to, or more specifically, to ask staff to frame a way that they can ask the province to allow for some more rental protections under the Residential Tenancy Act. And,
and that's standard fare, you know, that UBCM regularly does that as well, is, you know, when you have the legislative underpinnings of your government not working for you, is you seek to change them. And so it makes sense that you would then call up the Minister of Community and say, you know, we want these changes to the Vancouver Charter.
I feel like every motion that goes through Vancouver City Council probably has or should have the, and here's what other power we need, BC.
Yeah.
I mean, even cities, if it's shouting at the wind.
Cities are uniformly powerless in Canada, and you know, there's a big movement.
They do not exist.
There's a big movement afoot to ensure greater legislative authority on them, both in taxation and in actual authorities. And that's you know, something that every council wrangles with.
Yeah, it's interesting because I can see the contrast in the States, where cities have an immense amount of power compared to Canadian cities. And that leads to both very innovative policies in New York or Los Angeles or, you know, Portland or Seattle's $15 minimum wage. But it also leads to, like, Flint forgetting to do its water treatment or being restricted from doing so because it ran its own taxes into the ground and there was no overarching state responsibility to provide it in the same way that there would be for the province to do so here. Like, if something got as bad as Flint here, the municipality would just be dissolved and it would
except for all those places where people can't drink the water.
But that's the federal government's fault, not the province.
And actually, the federal government has moved very drastically. Like, the federal government under Trudeau, I will say, has moved very drastically in that direction of support of reducing the boil water advisory. So I should give them some credit.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. Okay. There are terrible things, but I was just trying to make a point about the constitutional order.
Well, and Metro Van governance, as Gordon Price said on the podcast as well, you know, handles water very well, so well that we don't have to talk about it.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say on rent eviction?
I just, you know, this one really is, yeah, I think really powerful for anybody under 40. I think, you know, the day that the motion passed was the same day that a friend of mine, unaware that the motion had passed, posted on Facebook saying that she believed a rent eviction was coming, that half of her building had already been evicted due to rent evictions, and that she was scared and trying to figure out whether or not she should just move now and not deal with the psychological consequences of the situation. And, you know, it was really cool that I got to post the article of what had happened and say, here are the new protections you have. And that meant a lot to those people. You know, I think we underplay the psychological impact of these rent evictions on people. It's not just the financial burden. It's really hard on people.
No, like moving is the most stressful thing an everyday person goes through, like in their entire life.
But,
like it's this and catastrophic medical things, unless you end up going to war.
But on top of moving, it's the sense that you don't have control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, moving is one thing. I've moved and I don't like it. But precariousness of housing is one of the most psychologically traumatizing things that we allow to be pernicious in our society. I'm really happy with this motion.
Well, and it also shows that the Gene Swanson Coalition is still active and plans to continue to be active in this council. And it's very early, so it's easy to take the people who are engaged in October and engage them in mid-November. Whether that will keep being the case next year kind of will show whether...
Speaking of Gene Swanson, is the knitting at council, is that like deliberately supposed to evoke?
Oh, you're not a New Democrat.
There's so many good memes coming out of Swanson. There was the one picture of her with
sunglasses.
Well, there's her sunglasses. Then there was her holding her head with
hands.
It saying, Melissa Giganova is speaking now. Here's a photo of Gene.
Yeah. Well, and the knitting, by the way, and Matthew, this is the different political camps that we run in, is seeing people knitting at political things is just a thing I've been around all my time of being a New Democrat or a progressive. I get that in your sort of the more corporatist world that you run in, I feel like it doesn't quite have the same culture.
I mean, the first thing that jumps to mind is the Tale of Two Cities, but it's...
I can't count the number of conferences or... organizational meetings I've been at where somebody was knitting.
All right. Well, we'll see which name she knits into the scarf next. moving on to our next item, the land value capture tax. Now, okay, actually, this is super important, but like every time I've tried to read about it, it just seems like it's bogging
well, and
down
that,
and dislike
that, it. I think that's a real problem, too, because we see on the Twitter conversations of people that are developers or are media people or should know about this, that they get it so uniformly and consistently wrong. I know Michael Geller and I had a bit of a back and forth on it just the other day, and it baffles my mind that politically engaged people who work in the housing sphere can't even grasp this. And people think that this is going to replace CICs. People think that that CICs already exist, so that this there's no need to do this. And all of that is untrue. And I think that the key point, and I want to actually just read out the key element of the motion, which is exploring how a land value capture could work within or replace Vancouver's existing system of community amenity contributions and development contribution expectations to reduce backlog and approval and fairly capture the value of wealth created by land rezoning and public infrastructure projects. So in sum, this may be an addition to or a replacement of existing tax regimes during the process of selling a home. And what this would do is it would result in the land lift that occurs due to our society improving things around your building would be captured by the city to be able to do for other things. And I think that that's valuable. We know that when a gas station gets converted into a community garden, we know that property values go up around that community garden because community gardens improve property values. You didn't do anything to get that property value lift. The city is enabling that through a tax incentive. Why isn't the city gaining some value on that property lift when you sell your home?
So it's worth mentioning this is Councillor Christine Boyle's motion.
Oh, sorry, yes.
One city campaigned on this during the election. They called it a windfall capture at the time, or windfall tax. I forget exactly what. They tried to use the word windfall to try to say this isn't earned money, despite all of the big anti-school tax signs that talk about people's hard-earned equity that are getting clawed back.
You've earned so hard through your toil and sweat of owning a house.
Didn't sell. That's a very smart thing to do.
And philosophically, we already essentially do it in some ways. So CACs, community amenity contributions, are applied when you rezone a property. So a developer comes in and they have a proposal and they say, my proposal is this, it's really good, but I need a minor change in the zoning to allow me to build it. And the city goes, okay, well, we'll do that. But in exchange for us bending the rules for you, you have to pay for a park to be built down the street. You have to pay for rental units to be included in your development. You have to pay for these, this, that, other thing that are viewed as community amenities. We do that already, but this would be a financial cost on all development, on all sale property, essentially, regardless of whether or not it requires a rezoning.
So it's like a secondary speculation tax that's going through a mechanism of a property transfer tax.
Yeah.
And rather than applying to people's second properties, mm-hmm. it will apply to the current one.
Yeah. And yeah. I think it's a much closer analog to an actual capital gains tax. If I bought stocks and I sold those stocks, a percentage of the valuation gain gets captured by the provincial and federal taxation regimes.
I think the other thing that should be pointed out is the numbers that get thrown around for this are 1-2%. Yeah. So people, I can imagine, freaking out if they think, like, my in-laws own this condo we're in, where it's worth about $1 million. If the SkyTrain comes to Arbutus, a couple blocks from here, the land value around here will go up. So maybe this goes to 1.5 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good example. I think my parents, when they sold their house after inflation, because they owned their house for quite a long time, their house had improved by, after inflation, about $500,000. At 3%, you know, you would pull in from that $500,000. So like $150,000, you would pull in $15,000. So my parents, you know, had the $500,000 lift in valuation when they sold. So they got that money. And 15,000 of that would be clawed back by the city of Surrey in that case to be spent on social housing or other things to enable and improve the city.
So this I am skeptical of, because it's like just adding, what it feels like is just adding more friction to the market. Like it slows down, it will slow down the rate of property transfer, which, like, arguably could slow down the pace of development or redevelopment.
Or it would create a disincentive to speculative flipping for you.
Yeah, although apparently I'm curious as to how much speculative flipping versus, like, speculative building is the speculation that people are, like, actually attacking.
Well, and
like,
that's the problem, is I don't think anyone knows.
Yeah, and, like, StatsCan has come out with reports, and BC Politics has come out with opinions. And you can take those for whatever you will. But, like, when I contrast this with what, like, for example, Yes Vancouver came out during the plan, which is amending, like, fiddling around with the CAC formula a little bit, particularly to include density in the rezoning as an amenity, which is to say that, like, their upzoning would include a certain amount of bonus, like, they would be able to count against the expected community amenity contribution by increasing the density of the development they were proposing to put on.
That is a component of the land value capture motion that Christine Boyle has, is it does say that it captures part of the value increase from rezoning.
Yes,
so if
there's, like,
a blanket rezoning to allow for four floors and corner stores, as the so overused slogan goes, then that would be captured through that land value capture.
Yeah, but, like, this is the problem, is that it's doing exactly the opposite thing that it should be doing, which is to discourage development by putting a drag, by putting a disincentive on the actual transfer of property in order to, like, assemble the land in order to build the four-story condo, like the low-rise condo.
I get what you're worried. Talking about. I know that people like Tom Davidoff, who spend a lot of time thinking about the UBC housing economist professor, this is his favorite thing, or it's close to his favorite thing. His better thing is auctioning rezoning, which we haven't actually had him on the podcast, as far as I know.
We should bring him on the podcast.
He will talk about auctioning rezoning. Yeah. But second, he will talk about land value capture taxes. And as far as I understand how one city and Davidoff have talked about it, they want to avoid what you're talking about, Matthew, as much as possible. And that's why the 1% gets thrown around. Like, how low can we put this? But at the same time, you know, we threw around a couple numbers and one development probably nets you 10-15 grand instantly. So it generates a fuck ton of money.
And we're now in a world where municipalities need to do more than they've ever done before. Social housing is something that prior to Vision Vancouver, the city never built because the province and the federal government built it. And so now we're in this realm where the province is expecting money matching and things like that for social housing building. So the city's going to have to do heavy lifting there. The city's taking on more and more role when it comes to climate change mitigation and other things. It's going to cost a lot of money. And so the question to my mind is, how is the city going to raise that money? And this is a solid way to do that, to be able to affect that without needing to do a number of other things.
And if it's presented to me like that, like this is a necessary and legal way to raise revenue that, you know, is on a, set at an appropriate level that won't discourage or have ancillary negative market effects, like, fine. It seems like it's small enough that it could be there. I just, like, the thing about it reducing the backlog, like, if it, the only way it's going to reduce the backlog is to discourage people from applying for rezoning and redovelopment.
Well, I don't. The rezoning is already, the spot rezoning is already covered through CACs. This would be if there was a blanket rezoning of the city, you know, like what we saw with the duplex motion, but in a manner that wasn't so infinitesimally small.
Well, we're going to have lots more time to learn about this because the city is throwing it over to more study, and there's going to be more debate this week at the council meet.
Yeah, Wednesday morning at council. I'm planning on attending because I have no life, apparently. And so it should be really exciting. If you're interested in following how the debate goes, you can follow me at Pat Meister on Twitter.
Wither the budget. Is it the winter of our discontent? Will the Stuart throne fall? I have no idea. Tell me what's going on. Property tax, well, in quotes, hikes?
That's a real question. There have been some rumors that they may not do a full budget.
I mean, well, budgets are really overrated.
That's exciting.
That there would be continuing motions and spot motions to affect different priorities, but that perhaps they might not do a full budget. I haven't heard this. I haven't been able to pin this down anywhere, but that is a rumbling that I keep hearing.
Well, it's a rumor that you may have heard here first or elsewhere through the grapevine. Developments. We will keep you posted, obviously.
On the other side, News 1130 and a few other places are reporting more rumors that around property taxes, people could be seeing a 4.9% hike for 2019.
That could be like tens of dollars per month.
Yes. Part of this is because people are saying the employer health tax is being applied to cities. This is the province's way of getting rid of MSPs.
Mm-hmm.
Which means the city needs an extra several million dollars, so people might have to pay an extra $108 a year as a homeowner.
So when I said tens of dollars a month, I meant $9 a month just to pay for people's health care coverage.
I mean, the employer health tax rollout was its own
been its own thing. I think you've covered on Politico quite heavily. But yeah, it's, I mean, that and, you know,
increases as well to garbage pickup and a few other things that they're looking at.
It's so fascinating to me that we get these big headline articles about a 4% hike in taxation. Now, if there was a 4% tax in how much I pay in income tax, that would be substantial to me. But a 4% tax on property taxes, when the average home is paying like $1,000 a year on property taxes, is pretty low. And that's the whole basket of property taxes. That's Metro Van, City Van, that's TransLink taxes, that's all of that on the property tax. The city component of the taxes for is really quite small.
So, like, perhaps it would be better and more informative for people to, like, step back and look at how property taxes are actually calculated. Because it's not that the city, like, sets a percentage rate, per se. Like, it sets the mill rate.
Yes.
But how does that interact with the value that BC Assessment comes in? Because
So that's a really good comment, because there is so much, as with all things in the municipal government, there's so much misinformation out there. You know, when somebody hears that their property value goes up and they say, well, that just means I'll have to pay more taxes. You say, well, if everybody else's property value went up at the same rate, you'll pay the same taxes as you did last year.
So how? Why is that? So that is confusing.
Yeah. So a city sets a target amount of money that they need to collect in a year. So this is...
No, what's helpful for that is a budget.
Yeah. True. So the city sets the amount of money that it needs to collect in a year to do all the city things. And then it says... And then it goes to its little accountants in the tax office.
We're
and they
big
say...
accountants.
I think they're normal size.
Any size.
Fair. And they say, all right, accountant.
Goes to the accountants of all sizes. All
right, bean counters, figure out a way that we can collect this amount of money that we collect in an equitable manner across the board. And if you own a property that is of a high value compared to other properties, you'll pay more. If you have a property that has a low value compared to others, you'll pay less. And if you have the average property value, you'll pay the average amount of the tax. And so it's interesting because governments at other levels don't target how much money they want to bring in. They target how much they want to tax you. So the provincial government will say, we will have, for this income bracket, for income tax, we will have a this percentage taxation. But at a municipal level, they work the opposite direction. They say, how much money do we need? Okay, go get it. It's fascinating to me.
But it is really fascinating. And it also seems like, it actually seems like how we talk about taxes in a federal and provincial context normally. Like when we say, oh, they've increased taxes by $5 billion or decreased tax. No, they've increased the projected amount that is going to be taken in by the taxes by $5 million. That is entirely different from the actual amount that might be taken in by the tax, as opposed to working backwards from the answer that you want, which is convenient, if nothing else. It just gets milled through.
Yeah, so the mill rate. And that mill rate that you referenced there is how they determine how to equitably do that. So they say, so it ends up being a certain amount of, you know, dollar value that they tax, and that mill rate means that everybody pays what they pay. And so that's why, you know, property taxes.
We've really done a great job of the mill rate is the thing that determines how everybody pays what they pay.
That's fair. I'm having a bad day today, apparently.
No, it is complicated because it's like it's this one number that goes into a formula that is applied to like a function of home values across Vancouver, and that function gets a little bit clipped off at the top, and that amount of money becomes the city's. It's confusing and it doesn't make a lot of intuitive sense, and it is not predictable for homeowners necessarily because, like, you don't know how much your home value has gone up or down compared to
everyone else's.
And you also don't know if the city is just going to decide to spend quite a bit more money and therefore decide to clip more off of everyone. There's two, like, levels of uncertainty.
On the going back to this idea of the city not doing a budget, it's striking me that from a comms PR perspective, there's almost a big benefit for all of the mayor and councils there because you don't have that week of stories, good or bad, of people screaming about property taxes, screaming about how much they're spending on police or not spending on police, depending on your ideological point of view. And instead, you just kind of fluff your way through spending money, which is not as accountable.
No, it is not.
I mean, the city still has to audit its books annually and submit that to the province anyway. So I guess we just won't be looking forward at what we're spending.
It's like,
this is confusing and makes me a bit angry.
Last year it worked fine. We're just gonna photocopy it and move on, and, you know, scratch out some numbers here and there. We don't feel like doing our homework. It seems a little nonsense to me as well. I think they should have a budget.
Well, and remember, there's just rumors, and I think they're all trying to figure out how they're gonna do.
Well, councilors that listen. And make a budget.
Well, I think it's interesting, and it does show, in a good way, if I were to bandy this, it does show that councillors are looking at a bunch of different ways to do things. And it means that they're trying to work together on things, I guess. We'll see what happens. I don't know that that's what they're going to end up doing.
Okay, this is a system that has worked perfectly fine since the Glorious Revolution of 1688. I do not see a reason to do away with the yearly budgeting process or the power of the purse.
Well, some of the arguments that would come up, and this is something that, you know, Colleen Hardwick has been pushing for the line-by-line budgeting, is that in previous years, the budget comes in and they vote on it. And council wants to sort of get more hands-on and look at the whole effect of what they're spending on different things. And maybe there's some value in doing that. We'll see.
Well, like, sure, but make that, it doesn't have to be done for this budget. You still need to do your work. And like, if you want to have wholesale structural reform, do it in a time frame that it can be achieved in. Oh my God. And it's Hardwick that's doing this. I'm all for councillors getting involved line by line if they want to. It's our representatives and our money. Like, there has to be a measure of democratic accountability. But, like, saying we don't want to do a budget because we don't have the budget process that we want, it doesn't make any intuitive sense to me at all.
Well, one of the bits of the budget that's not going to be around is the $38 million they're going to have to spend from the first year of the empty homes tax.
A slight asterisk. The empty homes tax cost a little over $2 million to administer annually, and there was a $7.5 million cost to implement the tax in the first place. So it's only about $28 million for the first year.
That's still a nice little chunk of change.
It's a ridiculous amount of money. It's amazing. What that means, if you think about it, on a very rough level, and I'm oversimplifying, but a unit of social housing typically costs about $100,000 to build.
Mm-hmm.
So for every $1 million you have, you can build 10 units of social housing.
Okay.
So if you have $30 million a year coming in from the empty homes tax, that's 300 units of social housing per year you can build. That is a lot. And if you triple the empty homes tax, as some have suggested, that's 900 units per year that you can build.
Unless the empty homes tax has the...
Intended effect,
yeah. Like the coercive effect that it is, and not the revenue effect that it like has a second as a...
There's
ancillary effect.
No, absolutely. Either option is good, I think, from people that support the empty homes tax.
This is exactly the kind of tax that I'm very fond of, which is like this self-regulating tax, where if the problem gets very bad, then the taxation ends up going up and the... Yeah. Like corrective.
It's a win-win. Starts.
Yeah, exactly. And if the problem corrects itself, then obviously the problem has corrected itself, as shown by the decreased amount of revenue that has been brought in.
Yeah. So it's going to be, it'll be fun to watch what the city decides to do with that money.
All right. Well, Vancouver's algorithm gets more and more complex, and so does transit in West Van.
Not happening anytime soon.
So the four B lines that are coming online for September of 2019, one of them is the East-West B line on the North Shore that I'm really excited for.
Wine.
It runs from approximately Dunderave, I think, to Phibbs. I still don't know where Dunderave is, but it sounds like a very North Vancouver place.
It's West Van.
Yeah, I call everything North Van up there. Anyways.
Don't. They are different.
Oh. Yeah. So one of the big things of the B line is that it requires a lot of infrastructure to manage. Because it's close to bus rapid transit, it results in lanes being taken away for bus lanes, queue jumpers at intersections, which does impinge the flow of traffic that exists. And some West Vancouver residents didn't realize this was coming until last week. And so a giant protest emerged yesterday where they took over a lane of the road that is going to be used for that beeline to show how much was going to be taken by having a bunch of people standing on it.
Ah, were those people moving in a large vehicle that was able to get them to where they were going?
Actually, there were about enough people to fit on a beeline bus.
Funny. That's actually marvelous. I was hoping that that level of irony would be completely lost on them, and apparently it was.
This goes in the, annals of recent Vancouver history of the wealthy trying to protest alongside the people protesting the school tax here in Point Grey.
Saturday's really not a good look as your protest day two, because traffic is pretty light, so it's just flowing. They didn't actually impinge traffic at all. But it does, I think there's an optics thing here where... We see a million cars and we see a million people, and we don't see 10 buses and the same number of people because it's so much less. It's like when people say no one rides in the bike lane, you say, well, they're always going by.
Gotta love those 100,000 person buses.
The bus goes back and forth.
Look, sometimes when I give numbers, they're not real.
I mean, they're real.
But yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see. And I know I say that a lot, but I think that beeline has a real opportunity to really improve things on the North Shore. And it's really funny to watch people oppose
literally
that.
The opposition was like, we're too rich to want this. Like,
in fact, actually, I was more or less, you're paraphrasing a quote of somebody that said, no one in West Vancouver takes the bus. Why would we have a bus like that?
Yes. No. It's so freaking annoying, as if there is no one else who lives in... or works in West Vancouver building the giant...
West Vancouver certainly has no one that works in West Vancouver as a housekeeper or any other low-income job that support the wealthy class.
So remember, when your housekeeper is late, it's your fault for not allowing rapid transit. Like, this is
so easy to mock and so trivial.
It's just like blinders. Like, people have no conception of how...
Well,
the economy around them works because everything is going well.
We talked about it with the mill rate, with property taxes. We talked about it. This seems to be the podcast of people don't understand things. People don't understand how transportation works as a concept. They just think about roads. and they don't understand how everything interacts. They don't understand what numbers are involved, the people that are involved. And it's frustrating from a policy lens because it means that you have this high degree of ignorance amongst the population. So you have to then convince them of something without them ever knowing the full amount of it.
Well, and it's so easy to mock this, you know, it's not an AstroTurf protest. This is real people out in the streets.
This is a real protest. Genuine grassroots thing. It's just been like delicately manicured by, very expensive gardeners.
It does point that, and I'm not trying to blame TransLink or anyone else for a failure here, but the need to get full buy-in on these projects, or at least enough that is always going to be there as long as we live in a democracy.
Yeah, and it is fair to say that for a number of years, TransLink was not a very effective communicator. I think that that's really turned around with Desmond, the new CEO of TransLink.
And the launch of their lifestyle brand, which actually I think has been a massive success.
But I still haven't finished that puzzle. It's sitting on my wall at home.
Well, but let's talk about that success. Their numbers are out.
I did not think it was physically possible for TransLink to beat the ridership numbers that they achieved in February of 2010 during the Olympics.
But they've done it.
They huzzah! October had more riders on transit than they got during the Olympics. And that, I don't know how that's even possible.
It was a particularly rainy November or October,
no,
I think.
No, it was a very dry October.
Okay.
Those of us that cycle, yeah. Immediately, no, it was a very dry October.
I can't remember that far back.
Which is also another thing, because
it's rainy today, so I think all days are like today.
Yes. But you do have like thousands, you do have actually thousands and thousands of commuters.
Climate change appears to be just wetness.
Okay. But yeah, you have tens of thousands of commuters that will switch off of their bikes and onto the buses as soon as the weather turns bad, and that's fair. And that wouldn't have happened yet. So I'm curious to see when the November numbers come out and the December numbers, because this seems to be a real uptick and a real shift. And January will be service improvements where TransLink will put more buses on the road. Next September, we'll have those 4B lines. This could be a real renaissance of people transitioning into buses.
And one of the new ways you can use the buses, this is their new pilot project wristbands, where you can get your compass card in a silicon band on your wrist.
They sold out immediately. So I had actually heard from TransLink that they were moving forward with the project some time ago, and that this was a pilot. And so essentially they brought in several thousand wristbands as a pilot, and they're going to relaunch fully in February. And they went fast. The lineup was hours long to pick up these wristbands.
People were ordering, I think, Uber Eats or things like that to get coffee and breakfast in line while they waited.
Yeah, and they've emerged on Craigslist at like $60 a band. But there's one element
of this. Is there a wristband value capture tax?
There is one element of this that I think should be highlighted that I haven't seen highlighted in any of the news, and it's the accessibility component. The cards themselves are very difficult for a lot of mobility-limited people to be able to use, and these wristbands really open the door, literally open the door for a lot of people who have...
Open the totally unnecessary fare gate.
Yes.
Yes.
But there is a huge accessibility boon to this, and when they bring it in February, I think it's a really positive move by TransLink. And also, you know, kudos to them for not charging for the material. It's the exact same cost as a compass card.
It's just not my style. I would love to actually have something like this.
Oh, I'm not a Livestrong kind of person. I don't wear those things.
Like, if I could get something shellacked onto my fingernail and just, like, have it there for...
The future is coming. Eventually, it'll just be an implant.
Something about that.
I mean, I have Google Pay in my watch, so I could tap with that, but I wouldn't get the...
I'm giving you the worst
stored
right now.
Value.
You have Google Pay on your wristwatch.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I hate you just a little bit right now.
The tap on my Visa died. I used the excuse of the tap on my Visa died, so I couldn't tap that. And so I needed to tap something.
Anyway, I want something that I'm not going to lose. Like, the reason we're recording so late today is I couldn't find my keys. And, if I can just encode everything onto, like, something that I, you know, have to replace once every 3 months by clipping my nails, that would be lovely. But until then, like... I guess this will have to do for some people, and I'll keep using my card. Can't use my phone. It's always uncharged.
Well, back to the North Shore for another exciting and fun story.
No, this is a shitty one.
This is an awful story. And I cannot believe, I think Gordon Price said it really well, as he said that the previous council handed the District of North Vancouver a really easy good news vote. They didn't take
The Delbrück, because they voted for bad news.
So the Delbrück project was a six-story building proposed by Catalyst Development, who, friend of the show, Stephanie...
Sorry, Delbrück, not Dilbert, which is definitely what I heard.
Oh, Delbrück. But yeah, Stephanie Allen from Catalyst, they were proposing the six-story building, which would be a story of a seniors care facility, as well as five stories of social housing. So it came to district council, and at a 5-2 vote, district council decided they didn't want social housing or seniors facilities.
Well, they said it didn't have enough space for families, didn't have enough parking, wasn't right for the neighborhood, also were fucking assholes.
Well, and in the parking one astounds me, because it was approximately one unit of parking per unit of housing, and this is social housing.
Cars are the only thing we care about. People are an afterthought. North End District.
And elections matter. Like you said, Matthew, the district, as well as a number of other municipalities, elected councillors that are opposed to a number of things that that the region was moving towards. And that this is one of the casualties.
And in the meantime, Ashimani invited us to the Building Bridges holiday party today, where they will presumably... like, whine about this and use no power because they didn't win the election. So,
we love the North Shore.
Yep.
Well, and elections continue to matter across the region. Surrey has nixed an arena project in Cloverdale, as well as a community center project in South Surrey, on the basis of a lie.
Well, no, I heard that Surrey has a debt of $500 million.
That is what the mayor said. The mayor did say that Surrey has a debt of $500 million. When you look at the financial reporting for the city of Surrey, they have a projected debt of $200 million and over $500 million in investments, which
are assets.
Are assets, and does not add up to a $500 million debt.
That sounds like a $300 million surplus, or not surplus,
And in fact, that investment portfolio...
Net assets.
And in fact, that investment portfolio returned $17 million in revenue last year.
Well, that's like... almost 10% of their projected debt.
Yep.
Why are we doing numbers? Why? This isn't...
So, Mayor McCallum has decided as well that they will no longer do sort of long-term planning when it comes to development of the community assets that a city builds. That is, the community centers and the arenas that...
Or transit.
...are needed. Or transit. Well, or apparently, please. We'll see where that goes. what he wants to do instead is do a pay-as-you-go basis, where a project comes up, and if the city can afford it, they'll vote for it. And if a project comes up and the city can't afford it, they won't. And he, in this way more operational manner than any mayor should, highlighted that the Cloverdale Arena is really an expensive project that they can't afford because it involves pile driving, and that's expensive.
This is the Hurricane Hazel Mississauga model. Like, Mississauga...
Yes.
Yeah,
I get the reference. The longest serving mayor in Canadian history.
Yeah, she served for 173 years and only recently retired.
You're not wrong. You're not far off.
And she had about the same impact, economic impact in terms of like lost opportunity as an actual hurricane on Mississauga, because she refused to go into debt ever and instead saved for it. And refuse, like, our entire economy is built on credit. Like, it's...
Yeah. Well, and this is really, like, this is really 1993 era reform, Newt Gingrich language. This is
Thatcherism of... is like municipal Thatcherism.
And it just took a while to get to Canada.
And
apparently a long time to get to the municipalities.
No, it got there in the 90s, and then it came back
It's how Doug McCallum ran the city the first time. And elections have consequences, and...
What did you think was going to happen? He said he was going to do it the same way. He's the same guy. You should trust him.
Well, this is going to be a problem.
It is going to be a problem. It will make Surrey not as good as it could have been.
Yeah. And community centers and arenas are...
They are economic multipliers. They provide construction jobs in the region.
They're vital to social development. Kids need to be able to get into hockey or whatever sport. And if you don't build arenas, it becomes increasingly difficult to play sports.
Well, and the way I can see it playing out with this, we build it when we can afford it model, if we're building a wealthy... suburb, that suburb, it turns out, can afford it. And you kind of just exacerbate inequality and disparity.
And similarly, I'm not saying that's going to happen. The South Surrey Community Center, the reason cited by McCallum for why that needs to be canceled is because they are going to slow the rate of development in South Surrey, thereby meaning that it is no longer required to build. And this is the region we're in now.
Well, let's talk about climate change, because this is all...
Let's talk about climate change now that we've talked about no longer densifying South Surrey.
Well, it's low-lying. Who knows?
There you go. The provincial climate change plan is now out. The much-anticipated provincial climate change plan, which will account for 75% of the targeted emission reductions that are required by 2050. It is quite expansive. One of the things that I would note is it calls for essentially a mass conversion to electrification of vehicles. So all the vehicles on the road by a certain point will be electric.
All new ones.
Yes.
But...
Well, and over time, that replaces the existing fleet, right?
And, like, at some point, the, you know, classic car collectors don't have a super important impact on the
carbon emissions. If we could get 90% of cars to switch to electric, we're in a real good place. Yeah. Especially considering in British Columbia, I think 22 or something like that percent of our emissions are from vehicles.
And then we can, well, no, they're from road traffic. Planes are vehicles. Like,
oh, God. Okay, things on the road. Sure, I'll go with it.
Yeah. that is a meaningful distinction because, like, planes are very bad for carbon emissions.
Yeah, one thing it didn't really do is it doesn't clearly lay out ways in which it's going to change municipal development patterns or things like that. It does have a lot of language at various points about coming up with strategies and plans to assist communities in being more walkable and assist in greater bicycle infrastructure, as well as helping cities build themselves so that people can get around without cars. So we'll see where that plan goes, because that could have a real impact.
I think they're in a very tough spot with the plan itself as the provincial government, because... When you start
in a tough spot with the planet.
When you start writing this clean BC plan, you need to only really commit to what you can do. And the province is a bit reticent to use its full authority it could and stomp all over cities and force density on them when a number of municipalities just kind of voted against it, even though, as all our urbanist loving listeners will tell us, urbanism is the future of saving the planet.
Meanwhile, Ontario has introduced a bill that would allow any municipality to violate any provincial environmental law, provided they do it through a zoning process.
Fascinating. All right. Well, that's what an...
Yeah.
But there is more to come with this climate plan.
Interesting things with that.
There's more to come with this climate plan. Like you said, it's 75% of the way there, and a lot of it does talk about ways it's trying to build partnerships with Indigenous communities and other communities. So I think we can expect to see more efforts to work with cities in the future.
And there is a lot of stuff, the way they say that extra 25% to get to the 100% of the required emissions reductions are going to be through a number of proposals coming out over the next 18 months that do sound like they will involve a lot of municipal stuff. So we'll probably be touching back on it later.
So the White House recently released a report on how we're all fucked, basically. And it talked about the bad impact that the changing climate is going to have on the economy. And so I really appreciate this plan for hopefully the impact that this is going to have and the opportunity that this could help us seize in British Columbia. Because if we do the hard work now of figuring out green infrastructure, if figuring out how to cut our emissions, of making sure that we have like a way to, you know, we figured out the most economically efficient way to, you know, space charging stations and whatnot, there will be abilities for BC companies to sell this to the rest of the world. And hopefully, if we can actually spur on our private industry into developing the solutions that are required by this plan here, there will be economic benefits in the future.
And hopefully we can all do that before the planet burns up.
I don't think that is going to happen, but, you know... At least we can be, one, happy that we tried, and two, make a little bank off of it before everything goes to shit.
That's the most liberal approach to it. But I'll just say, big L liberal, capital liberal.
Yeah, there's a problem. I don't think that it's getting solved because, like, China and the US, but I still think we should do our part.
Yeah. I'm going to be talking about this a lot more on Politicos this week. I'm trying to get an interview lined up, so I'll just pre-plug that conversation that I have not had yet.
Sounds good. I look forward to listening to it. So our Vancouverada this week is going to be a bit of a sad note for myself. In June, I talked about the Rifle Bird Sanctuary because my grandmother had passed away and she'd really liked it. My other grandmother, unfortunately, passed away this morning. The reason I want to bring her up is because we oftentimes talk about how Vancouver is the biggest little city in the world or the smallest big city in the world. And it's really apparent when you go through her life backstory. And so my grandmother was born to Vera and Jim Davies in 1930 in Vancouver. Jim Davies, my great-grandfather, she would want me to mention, is in the BC Sports Hall of Fame as a builder category due to him being a significant athlete when it came to cycling. He, you know, just like I cycle now, he went to the 1928 Olympics in Amsterdam, where he set a world record but did not medal. He was the vice chair of the 1954 British Empire Games in Vancouver. And my grandmother was in and around Vancouver for most of her life, but married somebody in the Air Force and traveled around. And she eventually did settle back in Vancouver with her children when my grandfather was posted to CFB Chilliwack, where she would take the Interurban to visit him when that would go all the way out to Chilliwack. And so it's really fascinating to see all of these connections that people that have been in Vancouver for a while have. And I oftentimes, I did a bit of mockery of the people that talked about how they're three generations of Dunbar residents. But it is really true that when you've got that time in Vancouver, you really see all these ways in which these connections are made.
Yeah, two of us on the show are from Alberta. And the way I often see Vancouver is you almost never meet someone who is from here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's the city of people who come and then maybe they can build a family, but then their kids can't afford to stay, so they leave. Yeah.
Well, and there's so many connections. My other grandmother, as I understood it, I went on a few dates with Jimmy Pattison when she was young. And my grandmother, when she was during the Second World War, when my great-grandfather was off with the Seaforth Highlanders, Vancouver's infantry regiment, when my grandmother was growing up, she was tutored in school by H.R. McMillan's daughters, or one of H.R. McMillan's daughters. H.R. McMillan, obviously, of McMillan Bodell and the McMillan
Space Center.
The Space Center and all these other things. And so Vancouver really is this tiny, tiny place where everybody's connected because, as you said, so few of us are actually from here.
Well, I think part of it is that it's like the metropole of Western Canada. Like, there are two Canadas and Quebec. There are three Canadas and Quebec. There are four Canadas. No, it's three.
There's now 10.
Yeah.
12, yeah.
Anyway, bunch of Canadas, but like Calgary and Vancouver as like the first and second cities of the West are like interesting because like I know so many Calgarians here. Like I don't know whether it's just that we like naturally find each other from the pheromones or like
no, it's the universal language of Lougheed.
Yeah.
You all pronounce Lougheed improperly, and that's how you learn who each of you are.
Not when it's the former premier.
Yeah. But yeah, so I wanted to bring that up because of the history and what we talk about on this podcast a lot, and also because it's sad. My grandmother was a really wonderful person, and her loss is really deeply felt. But it's neat to look at the way in which people over time have interacted with Vancouver.
Well, I think that's a note to end on. Mm-hmm. We are all sorry for your loss, Patrick, and glad you... I mean, we didn't force you to come podcast today. I want to be very clear about that.
No, indeed. Well, you know, life must go on, right?
Yeah. And we must podcast. Mm-hmm. And we will be back regularly-ish.
Yeah. Are we doing... We might have something
next week.
We're going to try and do something interesting this week. Patrick's going to go watch some city council. Ian and I are going to go and do a Facebook
brain melt.
Survey brain melt. We're going to have a couple beers and we're going to look at
the dark, dark corners of the local Facebook group internet.
Yeah. So if you have any particularly egregious posts, please do send them on to us, maybe this will get people to engage with our Facebook page, which is sparse. Yeah. So if there's anything that you would like us to take a look at, please do send it along. I can't believe I've forgotten. Please join our Patreon. It is available at patreon.com/CanbyReport. Patreon.com/CanbyReport.
Oh, you're pointing at me. Patreon.com/CanbyReport.
Yeah, there we go. And, you know, it has a bunch of benefits like our Slack, which continues to just be very entertaining and offer.
We finally sent out stickers to the people we'd promised to send swag, and a big shout out to those who got them and immediately took a photo of it on their laptop and tweeted out how much they love us. I didn't ask you to do that, but I wanted you to, so thank you.
Yeah, it's very heartwarming, and I've really enjoyed like friending the people who have been listening to us and have finally gotten their stickers, and apparently that was the spur that they needed to get in touch. So again, thanks for being part of the Camberport community, a very, very nerdy subset of the Vancouver political community, which is itself a nerdy subset of Vancouver itself. Without further ado, happy holidays, everyone. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, etc. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Patrick Mew.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
This was the Cambie Report.